Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Thanks, and welcome to the Information Blocking Workgroup Call on Exceptions. We will continue our discussion today focusing on the rule recommendations. I will call the meeting to order now. We have with us Co-Chair Andrew Chestnut. Michael Adcock will be with us in a moment. We also have members Anil Jain and Arian Malik, and we should have more joining shortly, but I'll turn it over to Andy right now.
Thank you very much indeed. Good afternoon, everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome to, I think it's the last meeting of this task force this week. We're going to kind of step through the feedback that's being provided. Mark, can you just bring your screen across?
Yeah, it should be up there. You guys see it?
No, it's just getting there. Move your mouse quicker. There we go. Okay. So I'm just going to propose walking through the drafting. I think all the members have done a really good job of pulling together our discussions and reflecting the consensus across the work group, and this is very helpful indeed. So shall we step through it? I think, Anil, you drafted this one.
I did, and I already see a typo that I thought I had fixed, but anyway. So I think the bottom line on this one is that it's really an important, it's a very important exception to include, because oftentimes we are dealing with the real life use of technology, and there could be any number of reasons why the data may be inaccurate, or the patient's data that has been merged within the record is known to be the wrong patient, or the provider who is taking an oath to take care of their patient somehow finds that sharing that information could put their patient or someone else in harm's way. So I think this exception is important. So our particular work group, when we are reporting out to the committee, I think really focus on a couple different aspects. I'm not going to read this word for word here, but I think that we are focused on making sure that the words corrupt data replies to a technically corrupt aspect of the data, rather than the inability to interpret the data, which may have everything to do with not having implemented standards or using inappropriate software or a wide variety of different things. And if you scroll down, I think the best way to really talk about this would be to talk about the recommendations and then go back and explain why. So,
yep.
One of the comments that the group had really focused on, which actually applies to multiple areas, and you know, being an MD and not a JD, I think one of the comments that I find sometimes that it's hard to know whether the text is referring to any of the following or all of the following when it comes to requirements of conditions. So we suggest that perhaps we ought to say that in bullet A, that we ought to say arising from any of the following conditions before listing out the conditions themselves.
So you're clear, what you mean is any one of these, not all of them. It doesn't have to be any one of them.
It could be any of the following, as opposed to all of the following. Yeah.
Okay.
And there are other parts of the regulation text that regulatory text that could be enhanced to do this, but you know, it's more if it's about consistency that there's other areas, but specific to this exception, this is one recommendation we would make.
I think we should make this as a general recommendation because it's pretty pretty broad in its intent. And so, I think we should contemplate just having a general comment that the reg text should consistently say any of the following or all of the following.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think the next item, we talked a little bit about the word corrupt and maybe thinking about it as a technically corrupt data, and others on the work group that were involved in that conversation, please chime in if I've misremembered or mischaracterized any of our conclusions as a group. But one of the other comments that we discussed was, you know, why is it only about recording and incorporating into the EHR? I think what we discussed was anytime we feel or the user feels that the data being accessed in the patient's electronic health record that is going to be used for access, exchange, or use, anytime that happens, if they feel it's technically corrupt or inaccurate, that they should be allowed to use this exception to not share the data downstream because it would cause harm by definition.
Yeah, I think in this case, sorry, I apologize, but I think in this case you did misunderstand the intent of the work group, or maybe I'm reading this the wrong way. So I think there's a principle that says if an item is part of the legal medical record, part of the designated record set, et cetera, even if it is thought to be not correct, the remediation is to correct it, not to not share it. And, you know, patients have a right to correction and the like, but that there are, that this exception should be broad enough to, in cases where data is non-interpretable, or, you know, obviously garbled, doesn't meet kind of base sensibility requirements, that this exception should apply in those cases.
Okay, so Arian, I think that's fair. In the discussion section, I think I do mention summarizing our thoughts on uninterpretable data. But I did see comments from our group around thinking about it being technically corrupt versus just having corrupt data, and also comments around word choices around record and incorporate into the EHR versus thinking about the actual downstream intent of access, exchange, or use. And maybe I've misconstrued it, and I'm happy to go back and review it so that we have the right language. But what I was trying to do is incorporate comments from two or three different discussions that we had on this particular item. But what you're describing is discussed. It's in the discussion section. And I also make comments in the preamble text recommendation to put some examples, because I think one of the comments about uninterpretable data is, that's a good one. I just don't know whether that fits the definition of corrupt. Because if it's not interpretable because I haven't implemented a dictionary or a standards way of looking at what those codes mean, then it could be a challenge. But I'm happy to relook at this within the context of what you just described.
So a practical example of where systems that I've had oversight for or managed do this is where, for example, you're trying to interpret a consolidated CDA, and the data that's incorporated in the consolidated CDA is non-interpretable as a medication because it doesn't have, it's missing, it's not actually adhering to the standard, and it's missing, for example, a medication name or a medication code or, you know, anything that would allow it to be actually inserted as a valid medication. Those are the cases that I'm referring to by non-interpretable.
So normally, and I just quickly logged it into the window, when we talk about data corruption, we normally say use it in terms of data that has lost its base integrity and is no longer understandable by the system that created it.
I think that's a valid definition, yeah.
Yeah, so because it could well be not understandable by a downstream system, simply because the downstream system doesn't understand the semantic it was authored in. That's a different issue. It's when, yeah, the creating system no longer understands it. So, Anil, might be worth just picking that up and trying to incorporate that in. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. And also look at the discussion text. I do make comments about not interpretable, and if that's not sufficient, I'm also happy to look back at that and review my notes and then review the comments that have been made on this document to summarize that. But sure, absolutely.
Cool. Well, I'd almost pick up that text and insert it where you've got technically corrupt.
Okay. All right. If you can make a note of that so that I remember to review that, that would be great.
I shall
on the document.
I can do it
on the document.
I can do that for you, Anil.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, let me move on to the third item on the list. So, you know, one of the areas where we thought that it would be important is that if you're going to use this exception to engage in this practice, of not sharing because you believe that it would cause harm, then that reasoning, a judgment by the user should be documented in the electronic health record by the appropriate user. And then the reasoning that was used must be contained within it, and then which criteria was used, and so on. Otherwise, I think you run into a challenge where you can't understand why the information wasn't shared, and no one can get back to the trail of what led to it. And that could cause unintended consequences. So having that documented within the EHR is important by the user, and then making that available by the vendor so that it could be used subsequently, I think is important too.
We're not always talking about cases where the data are contained within an EHR. Could be within an HIE, an HIN, other system. I can't see the recommendations at this point because of the.
Yes, sorry, I lost connection for some reason.
Yeah, that's a good point, Arian. I think in some areas of this particular rule, they do talk about it within the patient's electronic health record. But you're right. In other areas, they just talk about their EHI. So I can certainly change the language to make sure that gets reflected. Is that what you're referring to?
Yep.
Okay. So, or system recording the EHI. All right. Okay. The fourth bullet. Do you guys want me to wait till the screen comes back, or should
I?
Yeah,
I should have it up in a second. Sorry about this.
Mark, we need to sort out your IT.
I've been having some real issues here.
Your information blocking.
I mean, I think it's more the product of working for the government. But
all right.
Jeez. What the heck? I don't know. Someone else, Katie. Someone else might need to share their screen. I'm having issues. I'm clicking on the link, but. Oh, there we go. Great. Almost.
All right. You want me to keep going, or can you scroll down?
Yeah. It's like frozen again.
Okay. Well,
hey.
Nope. It's,
yeah, it's too far.
Too far.
All right.
Well, it's good to know I'm not the only one with technology problems once in a while.
No, I've been having them quite a lot. All right. There we go.
Okay. All right. I can't read it. All right. So I added the need to define corrupt under there, and I also added number three. I added record in the EHR or system recording the EHI. Arian, does that?
Yes. Help? I think it's perfect.
Okay. All right. So number four. Is really about bullet B, where, and I didn't even recognize this until we as a group started discussing it, but the language appeared to be confusing because the word practice was used in the same line as thinking about organizations. And I think the team wanted to make sure that we specify that the word practice in this particular item refers to the information blocking potentially occurring, the information blocking activity potentially occurring under the exception. And then we recommended rephrasing it. If the practice referring to the permissible information blocking activity relies on an organizational policy, the policy must be. And if we want to go back to B to see what that would look like, we can do that. If you scroll up a little bit, you can see how B might be a little confusing in the way that's currently written. So it says right now, if the practice implements an organizational policy, the policy must be. So it could be confusing in that some people may think the word practice is referring to a physician group practice or a group of providers, as opposed to the potentially permissible information blocking activity. Any questions on that? It's just a clarification to the text to make it more easy to understand.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Number five is recommend that we add a sub item under B that existing organizational policy should be reviewed for consistency with these regulations in order to prevent confusion and undue burden to providers who are going to be struggling to understand how their organizational policies that may have been written in a time that predates these rules get implemented and how they can leverage them. So it's simply just saying, like we have in other places in the regulatory text, recommending that agreements be revisited, we're recommending that the organizational policies be revisited in order to be consistent. Otherwise, I think providers could have an undue amount of confusion, and that could have a detrimental impact on patient care.
Okay.
Thoughts?
That makes sense. That seems to be consistent with what we agreed, or what we considered, yeah. Okay.
So I kind of have just I think that's fine. Just as far as like how that would work, because it should be reviewed, is that by ONC? And I guess
organization. Well, most organizations, when they have organizational policies, have standing reviews of those policies, and they have varying rules around how often the policies need to be revisited. But the organization that has the policy needs to review. And if we need to rephrase my recommendation to make it clear, should be reviewed by the organization. Sorry, I was about to write at the same time. it's okay. Yes, so it should be reviewed by that organization.
Okay, great. That helps. I just wanted to be clear.
Okay. And then the only other thing, and I think we discussed this once within our group around the preamble, I apologize to the group if I misconstrued the nature of the conversation, but we did discuss a little bit about where this particular exception may interact or interfere or relate to other exceptions. And if I recall correctly, we talked about how when would this particular exception be applied, given the fact that it may not be feasible, and when would the exception for feasibility apply when we talk about data and inaccurate data and the inability to share because of those inaccuracies? And to me, that there is a potential for there to be some confusion between those two. If it's clear to everyone else, that's great, but because it could be that once the data gets corrupted or it's the wrong patient, it's not feasible to share, especially around patient matching, then when is one to use this versus the infeasibility? And it would ask my fellow work group members to either say, yep, this is what we were thinking, or no, this is not necessary. Okay. So do we agree that we need some language in the preamble to help clarify, how one might, which condition one might use?
I have a general preference that if we need clarification, it should be in the reg text itself, and that the preamble should be used for explanation, background, examples, and the like. So if the reg text is confusing to read, I have a preference that the clarification be in the reg text itself. I agree with you that in some cases it's not clear where So one of the examples that I've given is an example of a perfectly valid consolidated CDA being sent from a so in our HIE activity, a completely valid consolidated CDA being sent on auto repeat from a physician or a hospital. And I think maybe I didn't actually get this into the comments on when we review it. We can remember if I got this into the comments on preventive maintenance. But I should be allowed in those cases where I've got effectively a denial of service attack to not exchange the data and not be an information blocker. I don't think that's an area of data corruption. I think that's an area of maintenance. And it should be clear when I am taking an action that's allowable and permissible, which exception I'm falling under.
Okay, and maybe just to help me, if I'm going to summarize that, we can throw that example. That's a good example into our discussion thread above, and we could throw that in there. Right now, as a placeholder, I said just recommend adding clear guidance of when this exception should be used versus the exception for infeasibility, and then we'll build that one.
Yeah, infeasibility and maintenance would be another one.
Right. That was the other one. Yep.
So,
Anil, you know, I have a preference when we're going through these. If we can draft some proposed regulatory text, I personally prefer that because I think that removes some of the ambiguity from our suggest you look at this, suggest you look at that. So, if that's helpful, then feel free to. If it's too much, then don't, obviously.
Well, I'm a lot more comfortable writing a prescription than I am writing regulatory text. So, my only concern would be.
That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to do it, but I think, you know, it's just going to be more work for the next person who looks at it and says, what the heck is this? But I think the recommendations, if they're not clear, you know, I'm happy to work on them further. And I think Arian's example, I think I can put it into number six in a way that does what he said. I think he's right. I think we want to clarify the regulatory text as much as possible. But I do think the preamble gives real-world examples of how this would be applied. And that's going to be important for people who, when they start to interpret these in the real-world setting, what degrees of freedom they might be looking at these with. Otherwise, I think the regulatory text may be too unwieldy for all the permutations. But that's just my thoughts.
That's a good comment, too, especially in this section. I think other sections it's been easier. This section is probably harder to do that. Cool. Okay. And incidentally, you don't just willy-nilly write prescriptions, do you?
Say that again? I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said you don't willy-nilly. Maybe that's an Englishism too far, write prescriptions. Anyway, moving on.
Well, if you need anything, I'm happy to write a prescription for you anytime, Andy. For almost anything. I'm kidding.
Moving on rapidly, then.
We did not hear that comment.
We did not. Oh, actually, the caption did pick it up. Did you do the next one as well, the privacy?
No, I don't. No, yeah. That was not assigned to me.
Okay,
I'm happy to weigh in.
No. Let's just go to the suggestion.
Hey, Andy, it's Val. I just wanted to let you know I joined.
Hello, ma'am. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so who got privacy? Mark?
I think it might have been Stephen. I think he got privacy and security.
Okay. Let's move on. Neil, what was the next one you did?
Well, I was on the plane yesterday. I was about to do the next two that were assigned, but they had already been done. And it, based on the language, it looks like Arian did them.
The additional
exceptions that we should be thinking about, which we discussed. And I thought I'm assuming Arian, you did those. I thought it was beautiful, and it encompassed our discussions. And the one on on I think the what was the other one? The third one was the other RFI one.
Provider disincentive, was that it?
Provider disincentive, yeah.
Provider
yeah.
disincentives, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, there's nothing I could do to add to what Arian did masterfully in terms of not only summarizing what we thought, but clarifying ways that I, you know, it's well written.
Okay.
Thank
is it
you.
Worth us? Is it worth us bumping down then to new exceptions and healthcare providers? I do want to, before we finish today, I want to spend time on Arian. I want to look through your most excellent prose around the fees.
Yeah.
And I'd like us to have a quick discussion about actually how we want to propose this up. Because
right. And you know, Valerie had I think some really good questions that hopefully I explained, but then I want to make sure that the words that I wrote actually match the explanation that I did. I think they do, but if what I read wasn't self-explanatory to Valerie, it means that somebody else is going to misinterpret it as well.
Okay.
That's on me.
Okay. So should we jump down to new exceptions? Quickly go to new exceptions, and then I do want to discuss the request for comment on information blocking complaint process to make sure that any of our thoughts have got into that, because we've done nothing on that so far, and then we'll go to the fees.
Yep. So again, the intent here was to note that much of the preamble discussed contracts by presumably EHR vendors doing bad things that implement information blocking. There are many cases where BAs are confined by BAA terms. I came across a great one in conjunction with legal counsel not to be named, where we had access to pricing transparency information, and we actually had BAA data use agreements, but we were sued by an actor, a non-covered actor through information blocking regulation, because it was felt that it conflicted with the confidentiality provisions we had in our agreements. And in that's another case where we would have been in the middle of a contract, adhering to a contract and adhering to information blocking requirements. So,
okay, so let's pick up on that one specifically, because Mark, we have addressed that in one of the other work groups, right? Work group three.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we've actually, I mean, we've got wording in there around, you know, any contract which contravenes. Mark, keep me on the straight and narrow, but basically saying any contract that contravenes the information blocking provisions, that those contraventions are immediately unenforceable.
Yeah, but it might be worthwhile to be clear. I think what we're talking about, Andy, is in the communications condition
is,
of certification.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that's specific.
This is a much more general. Yeah.
So you probably it's probably worth noting again if you want to make a recommendation.
Yeah,
well,
so I probably should add to this section in the discussion area, you know, other contractual terms, including confidentiality, et cetera, where it's not the actor themselves who are putting the contractual requirements, but it's an upstream actor pursuant to BAAs. And the recommendation really for ONC is to make it clear, either to add a contractual exception, or what I think is the preferred option is the notion of making contractual terms that conflict with information blocking provisions unenforceable. But just want everyone, this is an area where I think ONC should be in consultation with OCR relative to HIPAA and data use agreements, and an area where, you know, we want to make sure that we have clear clear language on preemption or precedence.
Yeah, I mean, so we have been working closely with OCR, and we will continue to do so. I guess my question to you, Arian, and to the group is, I think both those options, I think, you know, they're sensible options, but based on the conversations I remember, it seemed like, I don't know, that did anybody in the group, were they in favor of an exception for BAA?
I don't think anybody was in favor.
I don't think anybody was in favor of an exception. I believe that the preferred option is preemption. But I also am stating that from the perspective of being primarily a BA and not from the perspective of being a provider organization or payer PBM or other actor that's not covered by information blocking that cares deeply and meaningfully about the data use rights terms or confidentiality terms that they've included into contract. So I just it's a reflection that I think it's the sense of this task force that preemption is the right approach, but a reflection that other actors and stakeholders may feel very strongly about this area. So I'm just trying to be fair. I think in the spirit of information blocking, it's the spirit of this task force that preemption is the right approach.
I guess all I'd say to that is, this is the recommendations for this task force. So if no one represented feels that way,
yep,
I'm not sure. And also, I guess if you do put that forward, I mean, it'd be helpful from our perspective to understand what that exception might look like because, you know, we, like I've said repeatedly, we're very clear that contractual terms should not be used as an excuse for information blocking and will not be allowed. So I'd be curious what would be in that exception to kind of fit within that construct.
Yeah, so I think the task force would want to recommend, I'm going to test this out, I think the task force would want to recommend that ONC be clear about preemption in areas where contractual terms conflict with information blocking requirements in particular, but not limited to BAs who may be confined by BAA terms.
Do they have a clear?
Sorry, go ahead, Andy. I didn't mean to.
Arian, do you think that the ONC has not been clear about the intent there?
I do not believe that ONC has been clear about the intent. I did take the time to look through every mention of the word contract in the preamble, and all of the examples there refer to contracts where the actor themselves is the contracting party and where the terms are part of the actor's contracts. So it's things like non-competes or restrictions on sharing of intellectual property that can be construed as sharing screenshots and the like. But this particular issue of BAs confined upstream and downstream by terms that were explicitly put by the counterparties is not discussed, and I don't think it's clearly represented. And I know our legal counsel essentially comes out, I believe, I don't want to speak for him or her, but comes out on generally the same perspective of thinks this is the right outcome, but does not believe that the reg text is adequately clear.
Okay, so in the communications conversation, we did definitely talk about BAAs, and we did definitely say in there that BAAs would require rediscussion within a time frame. I know it's in the communication section. We should probably go back and look at that as well and try and make these all line up, at least so we have consistency.
Well, can we go down to the reg text recommendations? Because I think we want to, I think I was weaselly and hedgy because I didn't want to. No, I deliberately because I know that there are multiple parties. So I think we're recommending explicit clarification and say the simplest solution would be to preempt. And maybe we can just strike the last sentence.
Does that work?
Yep.
This is Anil. I think this is good. Quick comment on, again, not being a lawyer, but if I sometimes will see language in our agreements and where that if any part of that agreement is in conflict with existing law, that the entire agreement is needs to be renegotiated or redone. It's basically invalidated. Is that what we're writing here about preemption, which I think makes sense, is that going to force a flurry of activity of having to renegotiate or rewrite these BAAs or any other agreements that would deal with this issue in ways that could create undue burden? I'm not sure how to write it any better than it is now, but I'm just putting that out there as a potential unintended consequence. Because if you preempt certain parts of that agreement, then one could claim that there are other parts of the agreement that may then fall apart. And
we definitely had this conversation in communications, because we actually went and looked at the burden that would be placed upon contractual parties having to do all this renegotiation, and we considered that the estimation of burden was probably underestimated from when ONC had done that review, and that there would be at least a longer time period for the renegotiations to be undertaken.
Yeah.
Mark, I think that's summed it up, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. So if I'm hearing what Anil's saying is maybe there would be some kind of clarification, your recommendation about how, like similar to what we did in you all did in communications, as far as clarifying what would happen with those contracts. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yes.
Can we make sure that these two are in lockstep with each other between the two work groups? Because they're going to come together under a task force, so it will be prudent of us to make sure, I think, that they are saying the same thing and consistent with each other.
Can I play devil's advocate a little bit and just say, I agree with what you just said, but this is under a section called additional exceptions, right? So if we're saying that we do not think you need another exception, should we say that explicitly and say, we do not need another exception around this to basically be proactive and say, we're saying
that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. We're sitting here discussing something which we're all agreeing we don't need. We want to say something else, so let's say we don't need it.
You want to add that in, Andy? Are you able to do that?
I'm just rebooting.
Okay. I mean, I can do it. I don't want to type at the same time, but I'll let you do it.
Arian, is that okay with you?
As long as this discussion ends up somewhere in our recommendations, I don't particularly care where it goes. I do think that's the sense of the work group, is that this was the one thing that we discussed, and this was the solution that we proposed addressing for it.
Okay, Arian, can you do me a favor and go and look at the work group 3 drafting where this is discussed, and just see whether that sentiment is aligned with the thinking here?
Can you point me to the work group 3 material?
Yes, I can. Can someone from Excel who's on the phone just send Arian the link to the work group 3 document, please?
I can also pull it up on the screen, potentially.
Okay, go on then. I was going to give Arian homework, but.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you guys want to keep moving on, this might take a minute.
Okay.
Let's keep going, and we can give it to me for homework.
Mark's already moved, so we've lost the text. Oh.
All right. Well, yeah. Let me go back to the old doc.
Go back. Okay. Yeah. Well, Arian, we'll pass it to you offline. Okay. But I think Anil's point is a good one. We do not propose any other exceptions.
Hey, Andy, it's Val. Could I just go back to one concept? And I can't remember where it was, where it would reside in all of this. But
we had talked...
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm traveling, so my reception may not be great. At one point, we had talked about, you know, ONC had asked, should TEFCA be an exception? You know, and I think that the group's thinking on that was that it's kind of hard to say it should be an exception when you don't know what it is yet.
We might want to go to that section because I did actually put some verbiage around that to react to.
Okay. Oh, great.
I think because we were talking about whether if you comply with TEF, then you would therefore be effectively in a safe harbor.
Right. And so, I believe the sense of the discussion that we had is that we don't know what's in TEFCA, so it's hard to particularly point to a common agreement. But that that was the sense of the work group that an affirmative set of obligations that should be presumed to address information blocking requirements would be helpful to help actors move in the right direction.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, what I was trying to figure out, right, and I've had a lot of hats in my life. My current hat is HIE. But I think to myself, you know, without knowing what the TEFCA requirements are going to finally be, and some of those, like TEFCA contemplated, you know, HIEs being required to share information for HIPAA-permitted purposes, you know, some of that might not exactly fit into all of the information blocking. I wondered, like, what happens in the interim? And is that something to think about?
Yeah, so the way that I, as I said, tried to address that in these recommendations is to say that it was the sense of this work group that an affirmative set of obligations that would be deemed or presumed to meet information blocking requirements would be a good thing without pointing to something that doesn't currently exist or may have to go through another couple of rounds of specification.
Okay. Okay, no, I totally agree with that recommendation. I just hope, it's taken up, I guess, because in between there's going to be a total lack of clarity about what HIE's rules should be followed and all that jazz. You guys know that.
Yep.
Before we move off this one, Arian, intrigued on the IPR licenses for terminology sets, et cetera. What was your sentiment there?
So I think it's better expressed in the pricing recommendations, but there are, so among the many, and maybe I just need to take another pass at this language and broaden the set of contractual terms that an intermediary, a BAA, might be party to. There are this issue of upstream and downstream requirements or flowdown requirements is pretty common. And as an example of one of those requirements, I might, name your terminology vendor here, I might be a licensee to a terminology set that does not allow me to exchange information with a counterparty who isn't already a licensee to that to that information. And again, that could be a case where I'd be in conflict with my information blocking provisions and my contractual provisions. But that's a specific area that when we go to pricing, I think would be in the language that I proposed, an access or exchange or use essential IPR, and so we'd need to be licensed on a RAND basis.
Okay, and we probably need, I think we need to highlight the use essential classification there, because that's going to have, you and I both know the terminology world is a slightly checkered one. And certain term sets, fine. Other term sets, that's going to be more problematic.
Right. The easiest way to address this are the cases where ILM has... has purchased the licenses effectively on behalf of the nation, but there are definitely other cases where that has not happened. In some of those cases, that IPR and license is in practice essential for any access, exchange, or use.
Yeah, so something like SNOMED, obviously with a national license being procured, but others, not quite in that same boat. Okay.
Correct. Okay. So I think it'd be better useful for me just to enumerate some other examples here of where these issues apply. And then with respect to the IPR, just do a pointer back to the fee section.
But the major point here is we're saying these are not exceptions.
Exactly. I think we are saying these are not exceptions and that we recommend that ONC clarify preemption.
Yep. Okay. So we move into the next section down here. Or, you know, the information blocking complaint process. We've not made any considerations here.
Do we want to go to the provider disincentives?
We can do. I'm conscious that we've at least made comment in the disincentives for healthcare providers. We've not made any comment in the complaint process.
Yeah. Who wants to volunteer for the complaint process? It's not something I've gone deep on.
Well, we can volunteer Steve. He's not here.
Yeah.
But.
Hey, Andy, it's Val. I think technically I was. Oh, am I on mute? Can you guys hear me?
No, you're there.
No, we can hear you.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. I think technically I was assigned the complaint process. But I do need the work group's help on some of the specific questions related to the kind of data that they collect and what is most useful. But I did send around an email that had just some general concepts that I thought might be worth talking about and becoming sort of general recommendations. And then I think there's still, I don't know, in my head, I still have a few questions on enforcement and consistency between the CMS law, or I'm sorry, proposed rule, and then OIG and ONC and things like that. So you want me to maybe just throw out a few ideas?
Please do, because we're all starting to consider this one, I think, at this point in time, so because we haven't talked about this as a group yet.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think the first thing that struck me was that through the course of the last couple of work group meetings, a lot of people have brought up, well, you know, ONC needs to consider industry standards, it needs to, you know, think about what's the norm in medical practice and things like that. So that seems like a recommendation generally that as ONC, you know, goes through the complaint process, investigates, evaluates, all that jazz. There should be a big component of that there. And I did think that sometimes it wasn't clear to me when OIG is referred a complaint or decides to pursue a complaint, have they fully signed on, like the preamble and all of the intent above this? Like, I know, Mark, you said you guys have talked to OIG, but you couldn't speak for them. I'd want to make sure that both agencies have affirmatively agreed that that preamble is sort of the general intent as well as the regulatory language. I thought another recommendation. Oh, sorry. I have two others, and then maybe I can go back on mute. Because I'm
okay.
Trying to drive and read it. I'm sorry.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Go ahead.
No problem. I'm trying to drive and read at the same time, so it's a little dangerous. And
ooh, don't do that.
No, pull over. Now pull over. The committee is in no way endorsing you doing this.
Understood. It also seemed like maybe another general recommendation could be that ONC really needs to issue guidance, templates, other things like that. You know, you go back to HIPAA and all the misinterpretation. You know, it wasn't until a few years ago there was some really great documents that really made it clear what was allowed and not allowed. I think the informatics they put out there and things like that are a really great start. I would just encourage them to do more. And then there was a specific question about how we can maintain confidentiality of the complaints themselves. And to me, it felt like we should maintain sort of an innocent until proven guilty and should maintain that level of confidentiality. But I do think that we should recommend, though, that if, like, ONC sees some major trends or some really egregious stuff going on, that
there might be a little bit less due process and a little less confidentiality, especially if patient safety is at stake. So those were just some quick initial broader thoughts, but I really didn't have any good answers on some of the specific questions they asked in terms of what kind of data do they best need to investigate a complaint.
Okay. Mark, you were trying to interject.
I apologize, and I hope I didn't cause you to swerve at all. Val, I apologize for that. No, all I was going to say is I think there were a few questions in there that maybe I can address, and if there are others, just let me know. So as far as the OIG piece, just for clarification, you know, we like I said, we have talked and consulted with OIG in drafting the proposed rule, and also we're working on an ongoing basis on our referral process to OIG and how all this is going to work to make sure that OIG, as Anil has pointed out, and needs to have the proper subject matter experts to help advise when these cases come through and the rule is final and we're able to act on them. So we are working with OIG very closely. I guess I think the context of what I was saying to you about I can't speak for OIG processes is that they really are in charge of enforcement, and you know, once the case is on their desk, we're going to consult with them and provide that knowledge that we have based on the work we've done in the rule. But really, it's in their court at that point as far as discretion and how they go about investigating these different cases. So that's kind of what I was talking about there. With the guidance piece, Val, that you were talking about, maybe if you could provide a little more clarification. And I say that just because under this administration, we are a bit more limited in guidance that we are able to release. There's been some new, we aren't putting out guidance the same way we maybe used to. So I guess I wanted to get more clarification on what kind of information you would have wanted in that guidance, and maybe I could help provide it in another way.
Okay. I guess I could have used maybe the wrong word. If guidance has a different meaning or implication, I think really my only point is that the more tools that you could get out there to help people understand the rules of the road, checklists, templates, things, and I don't know. I guess maybe that's not part of the complaint process, but it could maybe reduce the number of complaints if there's better understanding about these new rules.
Oh, no, it's a great point. And I think we are, I think maybe I misunderstood. So, yeah, we're trying to give the public as much information as possible right now during the public comment period. But also, for instance, there's a FOIA exemption for complaints of information blocking. So there's special protections for the Freedom of Information Act if you are submitting a complaint of information blocking, and we're trying to be very clear about that for folks so that people will not be worried about submitting complaints. And we're trying to get out other such information, as much as possible, and are open to recommendations about ways we can better disseminate the information.
Okay, cool. And also, so Mark, something that I know you and Val have had a bit of a sidebar on, and I kind of phrased it in two ways. One was, in quotes, double jeopardy. So that a potentially information blocking act or something that could implicate the information, sorry, an act that could implicate the information blocking regulation. There we go. How would we ensure that it wasn't alerted to ONC and alerted to OIG? ONC looks at it and says, nope, that's fine. OIG looks at it and says, oh, absolutely, you're guilty of blocking. How would we ensure that not happen?
Well, so I think that wouldn't really happen because OIG really has the enforcement authority for information blocking. If there was an issue with a developer with a certified product that fell under the conditions of certification, then we would be reviewing that. We have authority to review that. And it could be information blocking if it was that condition of certification. But as far as information blocking goes more broadly, OIG would be the entity that would be reviewing and investigating. And ONC is providing technical experience and knowledge to help advise. But, and also we are going to be working with OIG so that we have a common understanding. I mean, in the end, it would be in their court to make the decision about how they wanted to proceed. But, we would definitely be open to conversations with them to help inform those decisions.
Okay, so it sounds like that isn't an issue.
No, I don't think so. I can pull up preamble language, but I believe there's some language in there about how ONC will interact with OIG on these cases.
Awesome. That's right. You don't need to. We know your computer's temperamental enough.
Okay, great.
Okay. Arian, have you got commentary here?
No. As I said, I have not gone deeply in this area. I think with respect to Valerie's comments, I think there is something to, if there's a pattern or accumulation, the public probably should know about it, but you can't both include the complaints as secret and not secret at the same time, and you can't have a process that's reliant on somebody saying, huh, I think there's something here. So, I wonder whether, and this is just a wondering, whether the raw number of complaints if there's some information that's worth sharing or reasonable to share while an investigation's going on, clearly the details or particular findings of that investigation probably aren't unless there's an actual finding. So again, just wondering whether the raw number of complaints is a reasonable thing. And I also recognize that opens the gate for spurious or malicious complaints being used as an anti-competitive behavior.
Do we have a sense for the level of anticipated complaints?
It's a bit of guesswork there. I mean, I'll say that I can't provide the number right now, but we've had quite a bit of many complaints come in to this point.
Yeah.
I'd say that there's an increase as well. Actually, I can't really say that. I'd say that we've had a steady flow of complaints, and I would suspect that we're going to be busy is all I'd say.
I suspect that whatever OCR does for its wall of shame should probably be the equivalent response here, and I think it is only findings that appear on the wall of shame.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, can you explain? I'm not sure if I understand the wall of shame that you're talking about.
So OCR has a page where they list people who have been who have had incidents, disclosures, breaches, et cetera. And it's somewhat jokingly called the wall of shame. But I believe it's only specific findings.
It's a public publication of found proven incidents.
Yeah.
And it's just equivalent have something similar.
Right. Equivalence would be FDA. I don't believe that FDA post notification of investigations they do, but when there are findings, that those findings are public information. CLIA only posts notifications when there's decertification or specific findings. So I think that's probably the appropriate process to follow.
Chapel or something like that.
Is there a recommend? I guess I'm just a little confused. I think we're recommending
ONC and OCR follow. Sorry, ONC and OIG follow equivalent processes for OCR, FDA, CLIA, and other similar regulatory oversight with regard to their publication processes, because they seem to work and seem to do the job that they're intended to do.
Okay, and just one more point. So is that when the whoever the individual or entity is found to have actually violated whichever?
I believe in all those cases the way it works is that only findings are published.
Yeah,
this is Morris. Just add a clarification, just a small clarification on the wall of shame. Just that. Make this quick point, which is it's in reg text that in the regulation for OCR that there is a duty to over 500 or more to publicly disclose. They have a duty to OCR to notify, but also they have notify the media, which is in reg text. I just want to clarify that, and we don't have any of that in our proposed text the way we have it.
Yeah, I don't know FDA reg or what's in or law or what's in CLIA reg or law, but I generally think the principle here is it's appropriate to publish findings or appropriate to publish significant findings.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think then that's a good recommendation to make if you feel that way.
Yeah, and I agree with Arian, and I struggled a little bit with trying to find the balance between confidentiality, but then, you know, what if something bad might happen? Maybe, you know, what would be helpful to me is just what are the other, like if ONC got a bunch of complaints and it sounded like, you know, that there were real implications for negative impacts on patients, like in a big way. What are there other tools that you have, or I guess you would just expedite your complaint investigation in a really big way? Or I guess I just want to be sure that there's some valve and some mechanism you guys have if something really bad is happening to take care of it right away and not wait for, like, a long findings process. I don't know. It, hopefully, you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think and I don't want to sound weaselly. I can't really speak to it too much. I will say that if it fell on the scope of the certification program, like a certified product was involved, or it fell under, that scope, then ball would be in our court, and we'd be able to try to expedite. I mean, as far as what OIG, I mean, we can weigh in that this is, you know, I think OIG will be relying on us to say this is a real public safety issue and this needs to be expedited. But, you know, I can't really speak to how they are going to structure their process. And again, you know, as far as the shaming list or whatever, I think it's, you know, I think you all should make that recommendation if you think it would be an effective strategy. But really it would be more ONC. We can consider it, but we can't really tell OIG. I mean, we can tell them that it's a recommendation, but in the end, we can't really tell them to take that approach. And I know they do have processes in place with civil monetary penalties and the cases they do now that I'm guessing they're probably going to follow. But, you know, again, that's their thing. So I can only speak for ONC.
Hey, Mark, this is Lauren Wu.
Yeah.
I wanted to respond to Val's question. So, Val, I understand, you know, we're really focusing on information blocking as a whole. As was mentioned earlier, you're probably aware ONC has authority when it comes to the health IT developers that are part of our certification program. And so for that one group of actors, there is an associated information blocking condition of certification to participate in the program. And if there are patient safety concerns arising from the health IT that is certified, we already have a process in the program where ONC can initiate a process called direct review, where we would work with directly with the health IT developer to try to remedy that issue. And so that's already something that was finalized in a previous regulatory process.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. And that's very accurate. And we are working in the conditions of certification work group 3. What part of the conversations they're having is about enforcement and whether the same, basically what we're proposing is the same, essentially with some variations, the same enforcement process for direct review would apply for the conditions of certification as they do for direct review currently for non-conformities with health IT. And as Lauren said, one of the conditions of certification is information blocking. So that was well said, Lauren. Thanks.
Sure. The other thing I wanted to maybe suggest that as this work group thinks through this specific request for comment in the rule, you'll notice in the preamble that we point to a form that is on healthit.gov today. We call it the Health IT Feedback Form, where it's sort of, you know, our channel for all kinds of complaints and information to us. And today, really, it's kind of a free text form. And one of the things that we are seeking input on is specifically for information blocking complaints or allegations in the future, if we should structure the field a little bit more rather than free text to collect specific pieces of information, and whether certain pieces of information are kind of priority or you might feel more necessary for ONC to collect in order to really investigate working with OIG any allegations of information blocking.
Hey, this is Anil. I think that's I think that's something we could certainly think about, the what additional fields and all that. But I have a question about the complaint process around information blocking. Are there is there an opportunity for the complaints to be around when inappropriate information sharing has occurred, where an exception should have been applied but wasn't? Is that in scope of the complaint process that ONC is contemplating here? I think if you
are you talking about more of like a HIPAA violation, or
it wouldn't be a HIPAA violation because that would already be covered under another one. But let's assume that I'm a provider, and I decide to use an exception that I feel that the data is corrupt, I decide to share the information, but it turns out that the data was corrupt, and the receiving organization says, hey, you just sent me a bunch of corrupt data. You should not have sent it to me. You should have not sent it to me because you should have used this exception. Where's that complaint going to go? Because I think if you're going to have complaints about where information blocking has occurred, then and we go through the painstaking process of laying out exceptions, there should be a way when information blocking has when it was permissible to occur under one of the conditions, it didn't occur and it should have. And maybe I'm not making any sense here, but I don't know how you can have a process by which you could take complaints that information blocking occurred, but not have a process by which you can have complaints of where information was shared, not under not a HIPAA violation, but inappropriately shared when an exception should have been used. I'm sorry.
I think you mean an oversharing. So where I'm probably the same as the words used in the deal. So it was shared. It shouldn't have been. An exception should have been used, but it doesn't rise to the level of HIPAA.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
HIPAA's dealing with certain. Okay.
So I think, you know, I think that I don't know that that would really fall in the scope of what we're doing, because the way that the whole construct of the information blocking provision and rule is that we expect, you know, the sharing of information. You know, this is in general terms, but if there's a really good reason for not sharing that information, then you can, if a complaint comes that you're not sharing the information, then you can claim an exception and say, this is why I'm not sharing the information, because there's a really good reason and I met all the conditions of one of these exceptions. What you're describing is that an actor or some an individual or entity shared information that they should not have shared. And I feel like that just falls under the responsibility of that entity. And that's almost the reason why we have these exceptions. We don't want, you know, different individuals and entities to feel an obligation to always share when they really should not be sharing. And we've tried to identify situations when they would not get in trouble for sharing, for not sharing that information. So I think what you're explaining is one of the rationales for coming up with the exceptions, but I don't really see how necessarily it falls into our purview. Maybe you can explain more if I'm misunderstanding.
No, I need to think through this a little bit more myself, yeah. Because I just thought of it when we were talking about a process of collecting specific data. And if you're going to collect the specific data that's going to help us understand the patterns and trends around where information blocking is occurring to help refine our processes, then and you're only looking at one side of the equation, then how are you actually going to understand what the false positive sharing that occurred was, as opposed to the flip side of it? So I let me think about it some more, and maybe I'll be more clear when I'm
okay.
When I re.
Yeah, well, actually, Anil, have a think, because I'm thinking around some of maybe the third-party IP or something like that, where a third party says, hang on a second, you shared my IP saying that you had to because it'll be information blocking otherwise, when you should have actually declared the exception of saying, you know, it would have, it's not fair use or something like that. I could see that, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it could be any of these yeah. conditions, and I think I get Mark's point that if the burden is on sharing, and then you have to say why you didn't. So if you shared, okay, great, and maybe there's other mechanisms for you to be penalized when you inappropriately share, whether it's HIPAA or some other contractual language. But I have a sense that the complaint process is going to be, you know, unidirectional. I mean, the FDA deals with it because they sponsor the clinical trials that show that the drug works, and then they get complaints when it doesn't work or causes harm. So there's a balance there. I'm missing out on what the balance here is.
Well, and just a point to note is that, you know, we've been getting complaints on an ongoing basis, and they're not always necessarily about information blocking in the, you know, as we're understanding yeah. it in the rule. And, you know, they're all I'm saying is if we get a complaint that has to do with HIPAA, we'll forward it to the appropriate party, which would be OCR.
No, that's not what you're saying. The point is, not that you get a complaint about blocking, you get a complaint about not blocking. Okay.
Right. Well, I guess all I'm saying is I still stand by kind of my statement that I think the scenario that Anil has described is kind of outside what we're doing with this rule. All I was saying is that we do get we get a wide range of complaints, and if it fell in the scope of OCR or another office that dealt with it, we would definitely forward it onto them. That's all I was saying.
Okay, yeah. But if there's a complaint about non-blocking, where a complainant believes it should have been blocked, you are the right people to handle that complaint, correct?
Well, no, I would probably say, facts and circumstances are key here. I can't really speak to how we would handle it, but I think Morris can speak to this because he has much experience with OCR, but I think the Office of Civil Rights often deals with inappropriate disclosures of information.
This is about exceptions under these regulations. So there's a list of exceptions.
And if a complainant says, actually, you should have used this exception, but you did not.
Right. But so what I'm saying is like the way that the exceptions are is that they only would be used when there's an individual or entity does not share information, and then a complaint is raised that they should have shared that information, and then they would say, look, I didn't share the information because of this exception. So
the exceptions are not creating an obligation to not share. The only thing that's creating an obligation to not share would be at a national level law, including HIPAA, and then potentially at a state level. And so if you're violating one of those obligations to not share, then the complaint should be handled by the relevant agency.
Right.
Which would not be ONC or OIG.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is Anil. I need to think about this some more. I think I didn't mean to open a hornet's nest here. I feel like we're going to have such a mandate to share that more sharing will occur, which is the intent, and that until everyone is educated about the exceptions, there's going to be a possibility, more than a theoretical possibility, that sharing will happen inappropriately. And perhaps it's a theoretical risk that, as you guys said, is going to be managed in other ways. But I'm a little bit worried that there may not be, if ONC gets a complaint about oversharing and it doesn't fall under HIPAA, where does it go?
I guess all I'd say is I do think that wouldn't be information. It wouldn't fall under information blocking. I think we'd have to assess what the facts and circumstances are and just, see which other office was the appropriate place to send it.
All right. That sounds good.
Okay. We've got 37 minutes left. I'm going to suggest we move to the fees conversation now. Can we do that?
Team? 7 minutes? In half an hour?
Well, we've only got half an hour left.
Yeah.
For the next 30 minutes.
Can we do fees in our face-to-face and cover everything that's not fees here? I feel like...
Okay. Yeah.
I'm
happy to take that direction. Just a dumb question, Elliot. Were we going to actually just say, look, we propose a new regulation that sits outside of exceptions that covers fees?
I thought we were going to propose to collapse 204 and 206 into a single exception that covers fees. That's the approach that I took.
Okay, I was going slightly further and say, given that we're going to collapse them together, do we actually think that they shouldn't actually be an exception? They should be a separate regulation around permissible fees.
It amounts to the same thing, I think, which is that the way that information blocking works is that in any case where you are requested information for a permissible purpose, that any obstacle that you place in the way of that request has to meet an information blocking exception. So it could, in general, I think we could clarify that negative to the negative framing is confusing, and that even though Cures asked for exceptions, it's better phrased as permissible reasons to place barriers to information flowing. But it kind of it all amounts to the same thing. So I don't think it gets you anything except for, it may exceed what authority was granted under Cures, because what Cures did is it requested ONC to create exceptions.
Okay, I must admit, I do find it a little bit confusing.
It is confusing.
and I'm not sure it was intended to be confusing. So I think the exceptions were intended to be reasons why you might block information or it might be acceptable to not share. That's what the exceptions are for. I don't think I read it that the exceptions were reasons why you might charge for.
Yeah, well, put it the other way, which is that I'm not sharing unless you pay me this fee. And then the question is that permissible?
And that's why I was thinking that we maybe recommend that fees could be in a separate regulation that just says permissible fees.
Yeah, and you'll see, when we get to that section, you'll see that I tried to frame it in terms of permissible fees.
Okay.
Because I think the permissible is easier for people to wrap their head around than the allowed variance to an exception.
Can we quickly ask the man who knows all these things? Mark and Morris are both quaking now. Mark or Morris, either of you. Is it like verboten? We wouldn't be able to. It's not anything that can ever happen around having a new regulation around permissible fees that sits outside the exceptions. Don't both answer at once.
I was on mute. I was just saying, I was talking to myself then. I was saying, first, I want to be clear that I understand what you mean by regulation. Are you saying you want to add a provision within this regulation or proposals for the final rule or a separate standalone document?
No, so, but within this set of regulations, within the proposed final rule, taking the elements around fees, which Ariane has done a masterful job of collapsing into one, and actually casting it not as an exception, but as a permissible fees that can be charged in enabling information. Only because it can get a bit confusing when you're saying, okay, it's an exception that we can charge a fee. And it just feels like it's the wrong place.
Yeah, so I think if I talk too much, we're probably just going to go down the road of starting to discuss fees. But I guess I don't totally understand. I think that the fees, whether it's two exceptions or one exception, at least in my mind, it makes sense, and that's why we proposed it that way, that is an exception. Because like Ariane said, the situation is, and we've heard about this quite a bit from stakeholders and from the public, that there are fees being charged, and the data is not flowing, the information is not flowing unless a certain fee is paid. And we're trying to say that there are certain reasonable fees that can be charged, both for access to the information, but also for the interoperability elements for licensing, that are okay and that would be allowed. And so that would be considered an exception. So I guess I'm not totally clear why it would not be an exception and how it would be structured otherwise.
Yeah, I think the general comment is that it is easier to think about permissible practices than it is to think about exceptions. It's just that CURES asked for a list of exceptions. To the extent possible, writing the exceptions in terms of permissible practices is just cognitively easier to wrap people's heads around.
Yeah. The fact that an exception, by definition, is an exception to the information blocking rule. So it's saying it's okay for you to block if you're doing this.
Well, no. No.
Well, I know that. That's what the cognitive dissonance of it is.
Well, no, just to be clear, though, it's saying it's okay to not share the information. I don't think we want to say, I mean, essentially, yes, but.
I know. That's the point.
And again, I look forward to the conversation. I guess I'd like to hear more from Ariane and the group about why it makes more sense to combine them into one exception than to leave it as two. But again, it might be another day.
Let's see how much we can get through that's not that, and then when we're face to face, we can spend our time working through the fun stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like we're
just a note. I'll probably still be, I think I'm going to be calling in for that, but I will be on, even if not face to face.
Well, I'll be in D.C. So anyway, okay.
Yeah.
We go to provider disincentive.
Yeah, because Stephen's been provided by close of business this evening. Where's provider disincentives? What number was that?
It's not a number.
It's not a number, is it? It's preamble 501-502. Okay.
And there's also something else that appeared to be garbled that you said I should take a look at, but I didn't know what I was taking a look at, so I didn't. So I had a question, and then I answered my own question when I was thinking about disincentives for providers. So I'll just describe maybe my journey. And it always seemed to me curious that Congress put a specific penalty structure for HIT developers, but didn't put a specific penalty structure for provider organizations. And as I was thinking about this and thinking about this section, it occurred to me that the federal government already has the mother of all disincentives, which is Medicare fee-for-service, Medicaid, contractual requirements, so ACOs and other value-based care programs, and then contractual requirements with VHA, DOD, IHS, CDC, SSA, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So as I was thinking about that, I thought the simplest thing to say is that in all these programs that the appropriate disincentive is to include anti-information blocking provisions as conditions for participation, conditions for coverage, contracts, and other similar relationships with provider organizations, and that anti-information blocking attestation provides sufficient incentive to comply with investigation, as well as sufficient incentive to comply with information blocking provisions. And in the rare event where, you know, in the same sense that OCR very rarely levies fines for HIPAA, but when it does, it levies big fines. In the very rare exception where practices can't be modified or appropriately addressed, it provides adequate tools, including barring from programs that provide an adequate disincentive for providers. So I sort of came out of this thought process saying, actually, the U.S. federal government has all the tools that it needs to apply disincentives. The one question that I had, and it's not, I didn't include this in the text, is my assumption is that the CADES are part of that anti-information blocking, and I have to admit that I don't know exactly how the regulatory flow down for CMS works for the CADES. But you know, I thought about and to be honest, primary care practices or pediatric practices are just so far down the list of information blocking bad behavior that it's probably not that worth thinking about. But my assumption would be that the CADES would be that almost all organizations receive a significant amount of reimbursement through either Medicare fee-for-service, Medicare ACO, Medicaid, whether fee-for-service or managed, or other programs that ultimately flow through Medicare. I just don't know how conditions for participation for the CADES actually work. So I'll just pause there. That was the thought process, and the recommendation is basically to include information blocking attestations as conditions of payment, participation, conditions for coverage, contracts, and other similar relationships.
That's cool. I mean, doesn't the CMS regs cover the CADES on this?
That would be my assumption. I just don't know exactly how conditions for participation or conditions for coverage flow down through the CADES, whether that's a state administered or CMS administered.
Okay, I see. Yeah. But I think we're going to stay mute on that purely because it is covered and we don't need to say anything.
I think that's right. And also, to the as I mentioned, I don't think that, you know, primary care practices or particularly pediatric practices are on the top of the list of organizations that that have engaged in problematic behavior.
Not by choice. Choice.
That's right. They tend to be on the receiving end as opposed to the giving end. Yes.
Or on the technically unsavvy end.
That's right.
Where they just don't have the ability.
One of the other set of requests is around pediatric systems, isn't it? So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I was just going to say I'm struggling with this one a little bit because there are already disincentives in place, and the question I think they're asking us is that should there be additional, as you guys were just discussing, additional things or different things, and they've already talked about the HHS programs, which is already covered under the CMS rule. I'm failing to understand exactly what they're asking for here.
Well, I am not. Maybe I didn't read the CMS rule adequately. But I am not aware that the CMS rule included anti-information blocking attestation as conditions for participation or conditions for coverage.
But I thought, I mean, I guess maybe I'm thinking of the programs like MIPS and MACRA and all those where you have to have the information sharing in order to get paid, right? Otherwise you get penalized.
Yeah, it's pretty.
And it does
at the margins. Yeah, it's pretty at the margins. Whereas fee for service and ACO payments are definitely not at the margins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the attestation recommendation.
Is there any information that ONC can provide us just so we
just factually what's in the Yeah, just factually, what's in the CMS rule and what disincentives were included in the CMS rule or not included in the CMS rule?
Mark?
That's the mute button.
Oh, sorry, that was a question. you're asking, repeat the question one more time.
Can you provide us any factual information around the CMS disincentives so that we're not simply replicating something that already exists and putting brain power into something which doesn't really require us to comment?
Right. So, without getting into too much into the details of CMS, I don't believe, there's existing CMS policies. I don't believe, and I can't speak to their rule, I don't think they address this specifically, you know, information blocking penalties in their rule. Of course, looking to what the existing penalty structures are for CMS programs might be something to do to look at, you know, as far as recommendations go. But I don't believe that this same question is posed in any way in their regulation. I'll say that.
Okay. Then I think we should stand pat with the language proposed unless there's strong disagreement with it.
I just want to make sure that I understand the recommendation. So we're recommending that as condition of participation for Medicare, maybe Medicaid, we've got to do a little bit more homework on that, that there it is a requirement that you attest to not information block.
Yes.
Okay.
And again, just to be clear with the questions that you raised, that does not imply that any finding of information blocking thereby disqualifies you from fee-for-service payments. It just provides a range of tools up to and including disqualification for programs for egregious behavior. And if you look at the practices, for example, in OCR, what you find typically is that OCR seeks to modify behavior wherever possible and only goes to a fine structure when, despite repeated attempts to modify behavior, there's been a finding, repeated findings of failure to address the requirements.
Okay, that's helpful, because that part of the reason I'm a little sensitive to it is that, you know, we've done a little bit of work on the CMS rule, and I know the AHA and some others are not necessarily have some concerns with well, they have some concerns with the requirement of, like, the ABT requirement. And part of what I've heard from some of the hospitals is that, you know, it's a very blunt instrument, the certificates of participation, and it's been characterized to me as, so if I don't do alert sharing, then I'm not allowed to have Medicare payments anymore, and you're going to bankrupt all sorts of hospitals. So as long as it's sort of a progression so that there's some, like, degree of magnitude for whatever bad behavior there might be, if it's just a tiny bit bad and maybe a mistake, there's one penalty within all of that versus, you know, purposely doing really bad stuff,
yeah,
and maybe they do get kicked out of the program.
So maybe, and I think I wrote this, but maybe I should be more explicit, that we recommend that ONC work with CMS to establish reasonable and progressive approaches that should primarily address modification of behavior.
I think that would be useful.
Yeah, I think that seems good.
Well, as opposed to what it is today, which you guys believe is a one-size-fits-all.
I believe that's a little bit hyperbole, and I think it's also, again, I think if you look at HIPAA, that's not the way that HIPAA's worked in practice. I think there's a concern that one violation and, you know, you'd hit us with a $1 billion fine. And in practice, regulatory oversights tended to be to work on behavior modification as its first lever, and then on, you know, but only reach for the big fines when there's repeated and egregious behavior. And I suspect that would be the way it would play out, and I think maybe we should recommend that that's the way it actually plays out.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think we'll have to go back and go and read the CMS regs.
Yeah, I thought there were penalties and incentives that were, yeah. But they may be carrying on those that were already in the existing programs, like the quality initiatives and all that. And I'll go back and read it too. I thought that those existed, and in fact CMS points to the ONC rule to say, and here are the exceptions and all that. So I'm not sure what I'm misunderstanding here, but it didn't have a gradual process, from what I recall. It was basically, you know, you may lose your ability to take care of these patients and get reimbursed for them if you engage in these behaviors.
So just to be clear, though, I think the CMS rule speaks about attesting that you've not been information blocking. I mean, they talk about that and the implications of a negative attestation. But that's different than what we're asking for here. Does that make sense?
Say more, Mark. Say more.
Yeah, I think you need to explain a little bit more to us.
I'm not an expert on the CMS rule, so I don't want to get too much.
JDs. Explain to
us. Basically, there's an attestation requirement for CMS programs regarding information blocking, and they discuss the implications of attesting in the negative, or saying that you're not affirming that you're not information blocking. And I believe that they discuss posting that information publicly, another such potential disincentives. What I'm saying is that what we're asking for are the actual penalty, proposed disincentives that would be for information blocking. But what they are talking about, I believe, in their rule is specific to the CMS program.
Okay, so you're asking for more general
sanctions that could be applied to a provider who are found, have a finding of information blocking against them?
Well, what we're asking for is, in cures, you know, as we've talked about, there's the penalty structure laid out by Congress is that, you know, for developers, networks, and exchanges, there are penalties up to $1 million per violation. They just say, you know, appropriate disincentives for providers. So we're asking what those appropriate disincentives should be.
I think we're saying in our comments that the appropriate disincentives should be anything up to and including removal, violation of condition of participation, but that we believe that the disincentives should be gradated and seek to address behavior modification wherever possible.
But removal of certificate of participation in what, Arian?
So fee for service, ACO. Yep. So let's posit a hypothetical, which is a hospital system that refuses to share information with a competitor who is, or with a local ACO who is attempting to provide value-based care payments that, you know, may limit future hospital revenues. This is, as I think everybody knows, not a hypothetical example. So let's presume, again, for cases of the hypothetical, that there's been a complaint, an investigation, and a finding that this was a permitted use, a permissible use, and does not meet one of the exceptions. So then the question is, what's the appropriate disincentive? And what we're proposing in the language that I've written is that, number one, CMS should seek to modify behavior. So let the hospital know there's been a finding of, that OIG lets the hospital know there's been a finding of information blocking and ask the hospital to change its behavior, but that repeated and egregious violations of information blocking provisions, that the final tool in the toolbox is to disqualify for fee-for-service and ACO payments.
Yeah, and I guess I just wanted to say I don't believe that any of that is in the interoperability CMS rule. So
I didn't read it either. So I think it's worthwhile restating it if it's something we believe.
Yeah, I believe.
So
It's
an unintended consequence of that, potentially, that you disincentivize people from participating in those programs completely.
Any hospital that doesn't want to receive Medicare reimbursement or Medicaid reimbursement is already free to not do so.
So where an organization is not receiving Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement, what would you propose the disincentive is for them?
I don't believe there's any regulatory mechanism for providing a disincentive. It's a good question. And this is probably deep in the bowels of, you know, is a hospital that is serving a local area in the confines of a state that isn't dealing business with the federal government, this is almost a constitutional issue.
Not to frame it that way.
I don't think it's a practical issue because I don't. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, so that's a little bit contrary then to my understanding, having, you know, I worked in the hospital sector for 4 years, and it was rare to find a hospital that wasn't somewhat reliant on government funds.
Exactly.
You've got some specialty hospitals where they definitely have a much higher commercial mix, and they sort of don't pay as much attention to the government programs. But it's unusual. But I guess to your point, even the unusual circumstances, we should ask ourselves, is there anything else we can do?
Yeah, and what my point is one, it's not so unusual that we can't think of any, because we can. And two, do we want to provide a push that's going to disincentivize other organizations who have a dwindling Medicare and Medicaid capability to actually back out even fuller from those programs?
Yeah,
that would be
I would then recommend that ONC and CMS work together to address information blocking. We believe these are appropriate tools for providers who receive a significant proportion of revenue from government programs. We would ask ONC and CMS to work out approaches for addressing actors who do not participate in government programs.
As OIG.
Yeah,
OIG.
I was
going to
say,
that's right.
Yeah, you definitely want to include OIG.
And OIG.
They are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we have a solution for it, and I think we just need to recognize that for the vast majority of organizations, this is a sufficient disincentive, and but there are rare cases where it's not there are no appropriate disincentives.
Yeah, and what we don't want to do, Arian, is inadvertently encourage organizations to stop participating or dwindle their participation more in government programs.
There is another way we could do this. It's not as strong, but we could tie in the state medical boards. So they've done that with opioids, right? So it's essentially adding something to state medical licensure that says that you're going to attest that you're not going to be engaging in information blocking as a provider.
That's not an ONC tool or a CMS tool, right? It's not a federal
so
U.S. federal government tool.
Right.
Yeah, we could definitely suggest
that.
Suggest
that ONC work with state medical agencies, provide implementation toolkits or whatever it might be to help educate on information blocking and promote some attestation at the medical licensure level, like I do for opioids right now.
Great suggestion.
Andy, you want to open the line for public comment?
I think we have to.
Yes. Operator, can you open the line, please?
And if AHA doesn't comment because they weren't listening.
If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
And did we have any callers in the public comment?
There are no public comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. Andy?
Thank you. At what point, somebody from the public is going to make a comment on one of these calls, and I'll be completely unprepared. It would be wonderful. Okay. Arian, do you want to move on to another section in the last 10 minutes?
Is there another section that we haven't reviewed yet? I forget what we haven't reviewed.
Yes. Go on, Mark.
All right, where am I going? Which section do you want to see?
Well, one of the ones we haven't reviewed that isn't the fees.
And isn't Stephen Lane's.
Yeah.
Okay, an easy one. What about the maintenance? Did we talk about maintenance?
Oh, we haven't talked about maintenance
yet.
Andy, I owe you
some revisions and polishing on both that section and the other section in feasibility to reflect the group's discussion. But we did talk about both of those.
You owe the group now. You don't owe me anything. It's fine.
Okay, the group.
Okay, cool. Okay, so we'll part that. Any of the others?
So it sounds like for what is it, Thursday, we have an agenda to talk about fees and then the remainder of Steve's suggestions. Yep.
Yeah. I must confess, this conversation over disincentives for providers who are outside of government programs has got me thinking, actually. And I'm not with a tangible answer yet, but more of a, I want to make sure we're not missing something here. And it might be, Arian, to one of your points, something that we have absolutely no legislative mandate to even address.
perhaps. So I think we can cover this with hand-wavy comments back to ONC, CMS, and OIG. Those are the best kind of comments.
Yep.
We couldn't figure it out, so you go solve the hard stuff.
Okay, we made a good attempt at some of the other stuff.
Yep.
So Aaron, this is Morris. Can I ask you just a quick question? Thanks. Just a quick question of clarification. So we understand. Is a disincentive where any federal dollars touch an actor?
Yep.
So it could be, okay. That includes grants, research, anything where federal dollars are received by an entity.
Yeah, and I should broaden the language. I included COPs and conditions for whatever, but yeah, grants, absolutely. So we should
okay.
make sure the language is broader and clear.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good point, Morris, because that's going to then broaden out sufficiently so to include organizations that aren't participating in one of the CAID programs, but
yeah,
actually
right.
might be receiving federal funding. Yeah.
Hey, Andy, if I go home tonight and make some modifications, am I still modifying the same document?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay.
The version I used in the task force was a one-off just because so people could see changes and track changes,
cool.
etc.
Okay.
Because I so enjoy creating one-off documents.
Yeah.
Okay. Operator, do we have any public comments?
There are no public comments at this time.
Thank you, sir. Okay, team, I'm going to propose, rather than starting up on something afresh at this point, we close for the weekend.
Sounds good.
Cheers.
Yep, have a great weekend, guys.
All right.
I look forward
everyone.
To seeing you all next week as well. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right,
take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.